I'm Terry Thornton, Curator of Education here at the Modern, and it is my great pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern, an ongoing lecture series that we have each week. Next week, the British artist, writer, provocateur, Matthew Collings, who's recognized for his wit and brilliant perspective on art and culture as the editor of Art Scribe, which was a very timely publication that regularly featured contributions by art and language. He also the creator, writer, and host of a number of TV documentaries in London, including the six-part series This Is Modern Art, and the recipient of a special commendation from the Turner Prize Committee will be here in conjunction with the exhibition Matthew Collings and Emma Biggs' Suspicious Utopias, which opens March 23rd at TCU's Fort Worth Contemporary Arts. So I hope you will all come back next week and bring a friend. Tonight, of course, we have the great fortune of hearing from New York-based artist Richard Phillips, whom all of you know for his stunning large-scale paintings drawn from found imagery, paintings such as the museum's early work, Girl Child, which, as I understand it, was the first purchase by American Museum, a point of pride for this museum. And more recently, what might be termed film portraits, two of which were premiered at the 2011 Venice Biennale, and a third at Art Basel's Art Unlimited exhibition in Switzerland last summer. With an MFA in painting from Yale in 1986, Richard was classmates with the likes of John Curran and Lisa Yuskovich, a generation of with exceptional painting skills applied to an unblinking look at art's relationship to desire. As they arrived on the heels of exhibitions such as Jeff Koons' Luxury and Degradation, Richard's own work has always relayed a Warholian relationship to celebrity and desire, giving him access and license beyond the traditional confinements of art. Perhaps more so than any other contemporary painter of his kind, Richard has achieved a level of pop recognition outside of the art world with fashion, media, and film collaboration. He has contributed to the television show Gossip Girl with a cameo, as I understand.
Two cameos.
All right. You're going to have to correct any mistakes I make over here. MAC Cosmetics, the Art Production Fund, and Visionaire. All of this alongside a very impressive exhibition record and art career. Richard has exhibited extensively throughout the U.S. and Europe, including Gagosian Gallery in New York, the Kunsthal Zurich, the Consortium, the Consortium, that's much better, in Dijon, Max Hetzler in Berlin, and White Cube in London, with the critically acclaimed exhibition Most Wanted at White Cube in 2011 and the 2012 exhibition of his most recent work at Gagosian Chelsea location. He is represented in public and private collections such as the Albright Knox Art Gallery, the Denver Museum, MoMA, the Museum of Contemporary Art Miami, San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, Tate Modern, the Whitney Museum of American Art, and proud to say, of course, the Modern Art Museum of Fort Worth. Most recently, and close to home, he was the 2012 honoree for the 2x2 Arts AIDS Awareness event in Dallas. And tonight, he is here to present Painting Beyond Reason. Please join me in welcoming Richard Phillips.
Hi, everybody. thank you, Terry, for having me, and thanks to the Fort Worth Modern Museum for having me here. I have to say, and I want to also thank Michael Opping, the curator here, because back in 1997, in Deep Ellum, there was a show that I did with Turner Rin Gallery,
And you can see that I just saw this painting today for the first time, probably since back then. Although over on the left-hand side is Girl Child in context of the original show. So, you know, there's a lot to go over tonight. But I do want to say that it is a huge honor for me to come to this museum. I remember seeing the model for this museum on Michael's desk way back when. And it really was the first painting of mine to ever be collected by a museum. It was acquired from this show, which is also a very rare, event. And this show is kind of an interesting grouping of works, which we're going to get to. There, it was preceded by only one other show of paintings in 1996, which sort of kicked it all off. And it was a show where John Runyon and Kenneth Turner came and saw it in New York City, and then I think made the decision to ask for a show here in Dallas, which I was very happy to work at. So I'm going to start this thing here, just so I know where I'm at time-wise. Okay. Anyway, so let's get started. So the last time I gave a lecture, I addressed more of the way my work has kind of infiltrated into pop culture and infiltrated into media. And it's done that way by, as Terry said, you know, it's been on television shows, it's been on films, it's been on purses, it's been, you know, it's kind of made its way through different parts of culture that are not generally associated with, like, institutionally credible art experiences. And so tonight I decided to take a different tact, and that is to focus on the works themselves as apart from all of that, you know, other way, you know, merchandising or the other possible ways that they come together. So back in 1996, the work that preceded this was a bit different, and there was a real turning point, and this painting was that turning point. It's titled Mask, and, you know, make a long story short, the works that preceded this were, like, of a very narrative nature. They were very, quite unhinged, crazy drawings based on found imagery that were arriving at my door through magazines. And so the painting Mask was appropriated in the traditional sense from an image of from a magazine, a self-help book, actually, where it was giving you advice about what to do after the divorce. And one of the things that you can do is actually give yourself a facial mask, and you're going to feel better. And I, you know, after my divorce, I didn't do that, and I still, you know, but at any rate, but. And also in the sense that, you know, painting on a mask is essentially reproducing this idea of the painting. And then conversely, you can have the mask on your face and then you can lift it off. So there was a kind of one-to-one correspondence with these images that that I was working on at the time. What I kind of stumbled upon, in a certain sense, was through looking at all these old magazines. And the magazines were from the late 60s and early 70s, and they were kind of stock photography and fashion magazines, was that there was, you know, these were advertisements that, taken out of context, had kind of a subliminal message to them, in a certain sense. There was a psychology involved in them that you know, was unspoken. You know, when the words went away, you had the sense that these images were trying to communicate. Some things were more hopeful than others. Other elements were a bit more, kind of vacuous. There was a sense of, at the time when I was painting them, you know, and these are all like large-scale images, that there was a kind of a sculptural sense of a void in the psychology or in the mind of those painted. And of course, that was intentional by the photographers in the sense that they were either advertising makeup or advertising different types of experiences. So, you know, the choices that I made were, one, scale, which was to make them, you know, as big as me or bigger, and two was to use oil paint and use a very traditional type of medium. And why? Because, you know, the oil painting was obviously developed foremost for painting flesh, and so that the way of using the technique of oil paint, you could, you know, create this vivid sense beyond photographic reality of the presence of a person. And if that was the case, then, and you applied it to fashion, which was traditionally considered not art, and take it out of its context, blow it up, and imbue it with the beauty of, and sensitivity of oil paint, you would create a kind of different experience. I mean, these were the images that were disregarded as art or categorically excluded as art in the 1960s, yet in the 1990s could be seen in a different way. And this show, you know, back at that time was a kind of paradigmatic example of that type of displacement. Of course, you know, it can't all be just, you know, portraits of individuals. And every show at that time of mine had to have a pet. So Persia is that painting. And it was, I had done earlier sculpture actually back in the 80s that was titled Pet. So it was kind of appropriate that I had that. And that, you know, the story from that image was that I was in a pet food store buying some pet food, and I saw this picture, and I just said, wow, you know, it really looked like my paintings. And so, you know, long story short, I ended up getting involved in that particular picture and making a painting of it, which I happen to like quite a lot. There's Persia. It's kind of like the David Bowie of cats, in a way, you know. And I probably was listening to Bowie when I was painting it. But you know, this brings us back, you know, after that first show, I mean, it really came out of left field, because you have to understand that those issues in painting hadn't really been brought up at that point. I mean, making big images of fashion and from that period, and using like 18th century methodology and then blowing it up to a pop scale were kind of conflicting elements that that changed the way that people started looking at painting. When I came to Dallas and began this body, you know, as you know, when I began the exhibit, it was kind of the first exhibition where I had an installation of work that was kind of cohesive. There was a front room and the back room, and in the front room, if we go, I think I can go back like that. We have on the left hand side girl child, and then we have large nude, and then the right hand side shaking, and they were all of a similar kind of quality of color. They're all related to one another. You know, you have. Subjectively, you know, you have an image of kind of rather provocative eroticism in the forefront here with a nude. You have the a painting of cross purposes of age, in the sense that with a girl child, you know, you have up in the museum, it was wild to see it, I have to say. it was kind of like, I can hardly remember painting it. It's so raw, and experience their expressions is such an and it's great to see. I encourage people to see paintings in person. It's, you know, I wish I had them all here to show each one in person, because it was so much fun to see this. Because, you know, paintings just simply aren't photographs, and they have this, you know, they're so physically made. But, you know, clearly this was an advertisement for hair products, and it was the conceit was that the model wanted to look younger, so she could use the hair products of the younger girl trying to look older, so that there was this. There's at first it looks like a Breck commercial, but then psychologically it starts to have this internal conflict that's irresolvable, and so the whole show essentially starts exploring the vacuity that was in the original show, where it was just fashion detached from itself, and starts to explore the psychology behind the images. You know, the psychology behind this image and the eroticism that's at play was, you know, this kind of upshot image was, you know, it was designed obviously to go as far out there as presenting, you know, the female form and, you know, in this kind of erotic excess. And then with shaking, it was quite simply an image of another shampoo ad. Actually it was hair dye, and it was like what happens when the hair color goes wrong. You know, it's like a bad situation, and you know, you are like having a panic attack. And so, but then if you take that same image, and then, you know, and it starts to become a drawing and then a painting, and that meditation, that process of transformation that happens in the making of it, you know, something happens. And that thing that happens, that sense, is that it steps out of an idea and becomes physical, and it becomes like an irresolvable thing. With photography, it's like kind of a two clicks away from reality, and you can kind of justify it. But with painting, you can't really do that. There's no escape from it in a certain sense. And the scale of it has a physical impact. All these paintings, it should be said, were made in a space that was literally this big. Like, I think it was 12 and a half feet square. And so each of the paintings were designed to fit on a wall in my tiny studio apartment in Brooklyn. In Manhattan, in the East Village, like between the windows, above my non-existent bed, and on each wall. So, you know, and I think the people who saw it knew the reality of that space. It was super tight. But another thing, it brought up an important point, which was I wanted paintings that kind of were like a backdrop for living, in the sense that their scale would kind of energize the space that one was in, and that their irreality became a shared irreality. Like the previous painting, Nuclear, or this painting, Alien, where color and the sense of physicality started to create something that was, really beyond reason, in a sense, something that couldn't be rationalized, but yet was so present. After the show in Dallas, I got the opportunity to show in a very big space in Los Angeles, the Shoshana Wayne Gallery, and taking that idea of subjectivity and these appropriated images from that time period, and the psychology that was present with them, I decided to do a painting of multi-personality disorder, or that a painting could have a multi-personality disorder. So this painting, which was quite large in the show, it was combined with another nude, which spoke more about these kinds of cliches of California freedom or the nude in the landscape. And so you can see how the scale of this space and the sense of the intimacy of the painting below on the left and the expansiveness of the painting nude on the right, there was a sense of trying to create dynamics that were across the paintings, that the sense of experiencing them was about physicality. It was about intimacy on one hand and about the expansive beyond on the other. But at the same time, the plane of the painting could be in the sense of the illusion of what I was working with, could be like a broken plane or an orifice in the sense of this mouth. This one's titled Tongue, and it's also another large-scale painting, but using the method of academic painting style, overscaled, created a kind of element of a dimensionality and intimacy that was... it was kind of alarming, even being in the studio working on these things. Another pet, that I still couldn't get over it. I had to have this one's titled Mouser, and this was a small painting, so there was huge jumps in scale, and it reminded me of this cat that used to be out on my fire escape. It wasn't mine, that kind of would hit its paw against the window and meow, and kind of aggressively, and it was really unsettling. So that painting was kind of dedicated to that. And this painting at the time went on a road show through Brazil, bizarrely enough. I mean, it was, so it's a very famous anonymous cat. But again, the seriousness of painting and all of its, all that goes with it, can have its lighthearted moments, although this is not a lighthearted moment for this cat, although the tongue is very nicely painted, I think. I had to bring this painting to the foreground, too, because I believe it was or is in the hotel in Dallas. Still? Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's called Eyeflower. And occasionally, as we go through the body of work, there are paintings that are made for exhibitions, and there are special paintings that are standalone paintings that I like to show as well. And again, this painting is 6 feet tall, and it's... when we see it disembodied on projected onto a screen, there's a sense of I would love to make them that big, actually, but it's hard to get the sense of just how physical these things really are, and that's an important point. In 1997, I was a part of this show called Hospital in Berlin, and the painting titled Braunbild, or Burn Picture, was seen you know, in context with Jorge Pardo, Liam Gillick, and relational aesthetics. So in a way, painting wasn't just seen at that time for its kind of more conservative nature, but it was also seen as in dialogue with other types of theoretical and conceptual positions. That being a weekend in the Alps where you forgot to put the sunscreen on and the results thereafter. So, and that was the study for Brownville. Occasionally there would be smaller paintings, and that kind of shows you a different way the painting gets handled when they're smaller. So from that sense of having scale building up and the psychology of these works starting to take on different purposes, adhering to representation became something that I began to question, and representation in its different forms. And with this image, it's an exhibition in New York in 1998, I began to explore the idea of pop art and of celebrity and its consequences by form twice removed. And what that means is, in the sense, is that the image of Rob Lowe, which is titled Portrait of God after Richard Bernstein, is a portrait of a cover of Interview magazine from 1983. On the right-hand side, we have a painting titled Jacko, which is the portrait of just the Michael Jackson portion of a Jeff Koons sculpture from the luxury, from the Banality show, and I believe that was 1989 at Sonneben Gallery. And again, these were two individuals. You know, the subjects had fallen into disgrace in various ways. Rob Lowe with his the videotape of him during the Dukakis campaign, and then of course Michael Jackson and all of the various ways that he publicly humiliated himself. But the way in which illustration and sculpture and these types of representations could be re-represented in a painterly form was something that began to take form for me, in the sense that illustration and sculpture were potential vehicles for examining this type of relationship to celebrity through a different type of lens. And we have Jacko. And then at the same time, there was this sense of a different type of force at play. And this image titled PlayStation was an image of what appears to be like this, you know, kind of suprematist girl in front of a Target, you know, with her shaved eyebrows and her 80s kind of drop earring. It's a different look at the psychology compared to the irreality of those illustrations and sculpture. Like, the realism here is now compounded by the fact that it is surrounded by works that don't have that type of engagement. So there is a conversation that starts to develop, like I spoke of before, in the way that the works in the show in Dallas start to talk to themselves, that that starts happening with these works. Likewise, just on another wall within that same exhibition is this painting titled Riot, which has, went on to have other applications later on, but in its original form was titled like a White Riot, or from that Clash song. It's an image of a 1960s smoke rings, eyeshadow, cosmetics, but painted quite large, and in the sense that there's an attempt at reality that's just been blanked out by graphics, compared to sculpture, compared to pencil illustration. There was different types of attacks on or challenges to reality. Going ahead with that, my next show in Germany, my first show in Germany, had the painting Scout, which has now gone on to have several lives of its own beyond itself. As mentioned on the show, Gossip Girl was in Chuck's bedroom. It's been on Towels with Art Production Fund. It's an edition of small paintings that can be bought online for to benefit Art Production Fund, which is a New York group that has done a lot of great works that couldn't otherwise be realized without funding. And so this painting is was seen in context with a couple of other paintings, revisiting this idea of different conflicting types of representations in a single show. The Antonio Lopez illustration called I tried to, you know, it's like the inability to say love on the painting. And it's kind of a 1920s flapper painted in a 70s style. At the same time, across from her was this painting titled The General. And I love this painting of the pug. It's like one of my favorite. It's basically from a Warhol experience, because early on, and even, you know, with the painting Portrait of God, I worked at the Warhol studio when I first moved to New York in 1986 in the basement. And I actually never saw Andy, but I did see the studio, and I saw his dogs, Fame and Fortune. And they were pugs. And these dogs were little chow hounds that every time lunch came around, they would, you know, make the rounds through the entire studio and finally find me down in the basement, like slaving away there. And so I had this kind of obsession, which I finally worked out in this painting. And within the show, I mean, I have to say, let's just go back one. I mean, look at the tongue there. I don't know. This is the cutest dog. And what's funny is that I ended up later making a painting of Valentino. And what's interesting about this painting is that you can see on the pockets of the two shirts is that it's the image of the pug. Well, Valentino is a big pug lover. This is Oliver. And it was the Oliver line of clothing, which was very popular in the 80s and had this kind of, preppy look that was, you know, kind of makes this into a very beautiful family portrait. And, in the same show, you have a portrait of George Harrison from the 1973 Pop Jazz Award for the song My Sweet Lord, which he was actually sued for over copyright infringement and lost. And that's a thing that doesn't really know. So this is actually a pornographic magazine awarding a popular rock star an award for a song that he ultimately stole from, it's the song My Sweet Lord was based on He's So Fine. So if you think of those two melodies, you know, we can start talking about, appropriation art and lawsuits and everything else. None of these images so far that we have are my own. They're all been appropriated from popular media, that should be said. But it was not in the sense of making a point of that per se, but and about the way that the images could live anew. So you have this image, it's that to that to that. Got the sense of the kind of conflicts that could come up with the pictures within the space. And, you know, moving to through to my next body of work, it took on more classical themes. You know, we were looking at pop art and looking at these different ways that we dress ourselves. In the case of Scout, like the cross-dressing Boy Scout, to, you know, the Valentino boys, to Harrison. This image, the classic image of Vanitas, was one that I exhibited in London with the likewise classic subject of the origin of the Milky Way, which is actually a painting that you can go and see, not this one, but the original that was inspired by in the National Gallery in London. Someone had sent me a postcard of that image, and I had it in my studio for the longest time. And I was kind of disgracefully trolling my source, stores on 8th Avenue and 50th Street in Manhattan. I think you know what I mean back in those days. But I happened to find this image in one of the kind of closeout areas for magazines. I mean, none of this stuff exists anymore, so I feel very dated by telling you that. But this image was really inspired as any Vanitas painting, as this kind of creation of the universe. And it was also a story or a myth based on treachery on duplicity, in the sense that Hera was startled, by Zeus bringing Hercules to her breast to suckle, his illegitimate child, and then she pulls away, and then the Milky Way. So, at the same time, within that show, we have the Vanitas, we have the Milky Way, and then there's the painting Spectrum. Spectrum, like like Scout, would go on to have another life, several other lives. It became a key piece on the show Gossip Girl in the Vanderwoodson loft right in the middle of the show, and it kind of just had a... it had a sense of, you know, being viewed by millions of people each week, and having its image just kind of completely and purposefully sent out into the media over and over and over again. So it achieved a different type of pop thing. It wasn't a named pop, but an actual pop existence, and that painting could actually happen to that. In this first showing in London, I think it was in the back room out of the main space near a garden, and it was a very ignominious, like, non-special spot. So exhibitions can have a funny way of having lives afterwards, or paintings can go on to have very different types of experiences. This, in the sense of all the color that adds up to, basically a white model on the left. So it was, you know, that type of relationship. So in the process of all this, I had my first survey show in the Kunsthalle in Zurich, and which was mentioned by Terry, and that was an opportunity for these paintings to kind of be recombined with the addition of new works. This is a painting from 2000 titled War, which would later go on to be shown in Berlin. And again, you can see the recombination of paintings so that those original intentions are thrown out, and then new intentions from curators come in, and images are changed. Here's the painting Jazz from 2000. And again, these images were simply appropriated. You can see War and Jazz and Jacko, but they were appropriated from a magazine I found in a train station in Berlin. They were basically sex ads, phone sex ads, and they became paintings, and then they became album cover arts and they became nominated for a Grammy for album cover design, especially Jazz on the right there. And I lost to the Dixie Chicks, so it was just a picture of them, you know? It wasn't even a painting. So. But, you know, that was back when they still advertise the heck out of albums, and so, you know, both of them, they had kind of a global reach, because EMI at the time had a huge advertising budget, so it was on billboards everywhere. And in fact, there was one point that I was in London where that giant billboard on the way out from Heathrow had Scout on it. It was like four times the size of any billboard I'd ever seen, and it was just an absolute trip to see the paintings starting to get that make their way onto the media. Likewise, with images of Jazz and War, this was a painting from the same period of time, same show in Berlin, and it was titled The Blessed Mother. And it was a painting, again, appropriated from like a, softcore magazine that, raised sexuality, submission. But, it's a painting, and it's a large scale one, too. And it was, when I was working on this, I remember her expression and that sign of whether it's acceptance or resignation and power and presence, all those things that we can't really put quantitative name to were present in the physical object. And it was really kind of an overwhelming experience. This show is 2001. It was a show called America. It's with the President of the United States of America, George W. Bush. It also had images of Old Granddad from Old Granddad Whiskey, a painting titled The Negation of the Universe to oppose Courbet's Origin of the Universe. And, there it was the first time, and I actually was thinking about this today when I was, to Dallas, is that It was really a single portrait, and it was a portrait. It was an attempt to make a single portrait across several paintings, and up to that point, I really had never seen a show that actually did that. And what I mean by that is that the relationship between all of the works and the subjectivity of America at that moment blends across the canvases. I mean, here we have an image of Old Granddad. And what is Old Granddad known for? Well, we don't know, because we don't know Old Granddad. It's like a Mount Rushmore for alcoholism. Or, he's only famous for what? passing along the idea that you should drink as much whiskey as humanly possible, you know. And I kind of like that idea. I mean, in the sense that in the context of the show, that there would be, you know, that sense of that limitlessness of not knowing, you know, what the limits were. With the negation of the universe, you know, I mean, I had felt like I had seen this Courbet painting over all, and in the sense of morality and sexuality and what can and can't happen, the sense for this painting was, you know, to have absolute liberation and be an absolute freedom, that it was not based on, you know, reproduction, and it was not based on anything, that it was based on sovereignty, absolute sovereignty through sexuality. And so in the context of the president, and now this is an image of President Bush when he was told that he was had won the court case and given the presidency, and so the context of that painting is the fact that it was black and white because it was the front page of the Daily News. The fluorescent pink, which is, you know, not necessarily presidential, was based on a Donna Karan lingerie billboard that was outside of my studio at the time. So it was like putting things into different contexts in a painterly way to set up different relationships. And, you know, likewise, the portrait on the right was the Gay Liberation Monument by George Siegel. And it was, and what was meant to happen with this painting in the exhibition, which was opposed to the president, was, you know, the laws, which were quite different back then than, you know, just this short decade ago, and the sense of the non-secular nature of this painting, which would be, you know, categorically impossible under non-secular ideology, was a sense of finding a kind of humanity or humanism within this portrait of George Siegel's sculpture with a 22-karat gold background, of gold leaf background. moving from there, I have to make sure that we're doing all right. Yeah, good. After that show, I was approached to make a portrait of Christy Turlington, and that was a kind of a paradigmatic shift, because it was the first time where I actually met the person that I was going to paint, and it was a collaboration between myself and the photographers Inez and Venute, who just had their terrific exhibition at the Dallas Contemporary, and I think that picture may have been in the show. And so it was literally taking that aspect of what I had, the basis or the platform that I had built for the original paintings, and literally getting into it, like getting into the whole production aspect of it. So I went to a studio and met Christy and saw them create this image, and actually had a hand in helping out how that would be, because they were making the painting to look like, making their photograph to look like my painting, and vice versa. So the end product was this large-scale portrait in a Marc Jacobs outfit, which eventually Marc Jacobs now owns both this piece and the photograph. So there's this kind of strange, cyclical or elliptical sense of how this type of collaboration would work. But it was a very unusual experience, which kind of foreshadows what I most recently did with Lindsay Lohan in my last show. Going from that point, looking at youth culture and looking at fame and looking at how that is such an ephemeral part of our lives. This show was titled Birds of Britain, and this is in the original White Cube space, which is quite a small space on Duke Street in London. And I was asked to do a show there in 2002, and it was the last show that was going to be done in the Duke Street space. And so what I did is it was the time of the war and everything, and I was thinking about all these different ideas, and I thought about making a painting of an owl, you know, as like the typical image of a predator with no that is atop of the food chain. So I went to the Strand bookstore, and I looked for a book on owls, and I found a book called The Birds of Britain. I was like, fantastic! I'm going to Britain, you know. Need some birds, you need an owl. But it turns out that birds obviously has a different meaning in British parlance. So I ended up with this amazing book by John D. Green that Anthony Hingis wrote the text for. And it was an image of the youthquake generation, the very same generation in London as all my previous paintings. And at this time, and when you look at this book, there was just one fabulous picture after another of the biggest stars in the youthquake era, none of whom went on to continue to be stars. And so this image, this exhibition, was a painting of a group of paintings as a kind of memento mori in the literal ground zero of YBA Britain, you know, of all the artists that ever had gone on from that that group in the 1990s showed at this space. And so this group of images were of the previous time in London where it was the reputations and the celebrity had blown up beyond imagination and now are completely unknown and now without any traction per se. You'll notice that in the background of these images that they reflect, and that's because the eyes, the whites of the eyes, the teeth in the backgrounds are all gilded with aluminum. In the sense that, Roman sculpture used to have that as a way of like kind of creating a sense of an aliveness. They gilded with gold and did all the polychrome to make their sculptures seem alive. We only see them as monochrome images. But with this sense, when you walk past these portraits, the sense that they're hollow, that you can see through them, it was very uncanny. So not only were they kind of a memento mori for a time past, but they were also kind of a disembodied, almost zombie-like quality to their absence of physical painted volume. So that was a sense of looking at not like Michael Jackson or Rob Lowe, whose fame continued on, but these are of individuals who had great fame in context and then lost it all. And then again, this is the Kunstverein Hamburg, and I put these paintings in again to show and kind of make a case for the fact that when you bring all of these works together, different conversations between them start happening, and that the experience of paintings and context can have like a kind of energizing and a very surprising effect. I mean, I found that, I have to say, this is literally one of the most beautiful museums I've ever been to. I mean, I just love the architecture here. I love how you come upon paintings and see architecture and see them. So I'm still kind of charged up after seeing that. So when I look at this and I see all of my paintings in this space, of course, it looks all right. But recombinations of pictures from Dallas, there's different conversations develop. Going ahead, this is another survey in Dijon that followed that one. This is a portrait titled Bukkake, after this kind of sex fetish for in Japanese culture. This show in Dijon in 2004 was my first survey show of drawing, but then it also had two shows that I never got to show anywhere else. Within it. So there was two solo shows and a drawing show within a museum show. So it was kind of like a 3-for-1 bonus thing. And the paintings that are within the show were based on an exhibition that I was focusing on nationalistic themes. So the first one being a kind of national, and not particularly widely known, fetish, is matched with this painting, which is of a Swiss painter named Adolf Dietrich, who will reappear again later with my work. And this painting is called Similar to Squirrels. And it's he was considered a national folk hero in Switzerland for his terrific paintings that he made of local Swiss scenes. this portrait of Joschka Fischer, the foreign minister for Germany at the time. This was from an advertisement for a political campaign that he was running for the Green Party. Now, Joschka had a very controversial beginning as a member of the left in the 1960s student revolution, and he went on to play a very big part in contemporary politics and Germany's position during the run-up to the Iraq War as well. But this type of portrait based on a political poster, again, you know, very different from President Bush, but looking into how politics and art transverse one another's lines. The emblem up in the upper right-hand corner is a Mont Blanc symbol, and this was a commission by the Mont Blanc Corporation, and it hangs in the lobby of their flagship headquarters in Germany. Likewise, national currency was a part of it, and the painting on the left, titled simply "Dollar," it's the dollar symbol, is paired with a portrait of a praying Demi Moore. Her prayer is not unmet. I mean, her prayers do get met in this exhibition. Here is the national currency of that painting. It's a very large painting. Her prayers are met with Deepak Chopra. And this is the biggest painting that I've ever made. It's a 27-foot long painting of Deepak Chopra. Deepak Chopra is known for the book, The Seven Laws of Spiritual Success. So I made seven Deepak Chopras all in a row. And at the time, Demi Moore was a very publicized follower of his. So In an exhibition that explored the relationship and implementation of nationalistic themes, you have the opposite of nation, but you have this idea of spirituality, of prayer, and you have the idea of how it's tied to commercialism and to celebrity and to these types of exploits. Something quite secular in a non-secular with a non-secular intent. So the sense that the unusual relationships between media and the concept of a spirituality are at play, you know, and all those paintings were set against the groupings of drawings throughout my whole career. In 2005, following that exhibition, I did two shows which had like architectural interventions. At the same time, they combined classic portraiture with these illustrations. And the basic setup was that these illustrations were amidst realistic portraits of the covers from 1950s men's magazines. I think that the magazine was titled Adam's Eve from the time. And on the covers of these magazines, you had these very like conventional, provocative poses. What you're seeing here is an architectural intervention. The gallery was bisected diagonally, and more than half of its space was cut off, and all the paintings were hung on an individual wall rather than conventionally around the space. And they were hung in this manner to alternate between realism of the portraits to the irreality of these very kind of negligibly worked out illustrations of sexuality in one case, this nude boxer, and then one titled Southwestern Theme on the right. Following this exhibition, and I mean, they were, you know, the vividness of the color and the straight up, you know, provocation of the paintings was meant to create a kind of dynamic of physical reality with intended reality of these kind of lascivious illustrations. In London, the diagonal theme was eradicated for a panopticon, and the title of that show was titled Michael Fried, after the art historian. I decided to title my show An Art Historian. And in the sense that, and all of what that implied. Now, Michael Fried is very well known for his text, Art and Objecthood, which became unwittingly the foundation for how we understand minimalism, in the sense that his argument was that the theatricality of minimalism was based on the idea of presence over presentness. And in this exhibition, it's kind of a perversion of that idea, and art can be perverted that way. I even titled the portrait in the center of the show Michael Fried, and that's clearly not Michael Fried, the art historian, but it's a lie, and it's just a naming of. So the show, in essence, became one of, again, reality and irreality, of laying claim to art history and laying claim to art historical ideas with no legitimacy, and at the same time showing illustration. This one was titled Herzausreißer, which in translated means heart ripper outer. There was a sense that, beyond reason, beyond rationality, that there wasn't that I was not compelled to, inform correctly, that I was not, I grew up in I was in high school in the late 70s, it was a punk generation. I moved directly to Boston and basically spent my life in nightclubs while I was should have been going to school, I guess, and listening to music and all that. So that spirit holds true with my work, even though it's oil painting and I have to stand painting in my studio against the wall that way. So again, combination of these elements. Making a leap from there, this is a huge painting. It's a painting titled Hell, and this is in 2007, when we're in the midst of everything in the Middle East, and the questions abound about the legitimacy of all of that, and the sense of malevolent power and the forces behind that globally. We're at we're all around us all the time. Here we are in the Gagosian Gallery in Los Angeles. This is my first exhibition with the gallery, and that type of punk element in the painting titled "Fuck You" on the right, to the image of the Lord's Resistance child soldier in the middle, to a painting that is falsely attributed to being Isa Genskin on the right hand side, to a painting titled "Death and June" on the left, explores the relationship between between aesthetics, malevolent power, and that kind of gray area where art is complicit in all of those elements. And again, the element of psychology, the capacity for painting to communicate that differently than the photography, to look at subjects differently, to jar it out of a certain context was important. The painting on the right, titled Deutsche Jägerschaft, was a portrait of a piece of Hermann Göring's stationery when he was the head of the Deutsche Jägerschaft. He was also notoriously behind most of the art acquisition of the Third Reich, and he, so that sense of art being in service to illegitimate and malevolent force is a subtext of this exhibition. At the same time, we have this portrait of Tom Cruise by a 12-year-old, and I made a large painting of that. It was literally on this wrinkled piece of paper, and I found it on one of these websites called Portrait of, Celebrity, you can submit your drawing. I guess I could have resubmitted his drawing, but it was in the context of a painting titled "Awaken to Myth," which was a nude, which was very much of a kind of a 1930s, purity and the sense of. At the same time, there was a bit of psychedelia in that. It was also. I got my owl painting done. Curiously, on the left-hand side, another relationship to Jeff Koons, in the sense that this painting was titled "Pre-Banality," and making reference to the Banality show and of the very famous porcelain sculpture ushering in banality. And, you know, at that point, looking at institutions, you know, whether that they were governmental, whether they were legal, you know, whether they had different points, was something that my work was like, you know, kind of taking on one after another. And in 2009, I did an exhibition titled New Museum in New York City at Gagosian's space on 980 Madison Avenue, which is an important architectural space in the sense that there are many, many shows of great kind of import have happened in that space over the years. And to me, the idea of laying claim to the idea of museum or authority was something that had to be looked at as, you know, and it was not a popular decision to call that show New Museum and use the New Museum's graphics as mine, but inverted in my piece. This was the title painting for the show because it actually shows an image of two men on the Bowery in 1973 on the location of the New Museum, where it is now. You know, the idea of taking that context and putting, re-putting into context with a kind of social realism portrait was the way that the show sort of began. And it was also shown with images, you know, Coco Rocha on one hand, this model, who is a legit, like a proper fashion model. To the right is a softcore porn image that was inverted and had one of Adolf Dietrich's, we remember him from previously, his landscapes in the background, and titled Der Bodensee, of the Der Bodensee. This painting titled Freeze was a very large painting in the show, which I think lasted about 2 weeks within the show before it was taken down from the show. And obviously exploring the hegemony of art, media, and its relationships to how legitimacy is conferred in our lovely art world. Likewise, the idea of falsehood that was being explored, the idea of naming things, of making claims towards leadership, authority, integrity, and all of that. This painting was titled Message Force Multiplier, which is a term the New York Times came up with to describe retired military personnel who were taking positions in the media in order to explain the war in Iraq while at the same time being lobbyists for for the military industrial complex. So the idea of taking a message and being able to influence both sides of the media at the same time was an issue that I was interested in looking at in painting. This portrait of a model, a male model, dressed up as a Marine for a Marine advertisement of to cajole people to join the Marines, was set against a Swiss landscape, a frozen Swiss landscape, the same one that was in the Der Bodensee, this painting. So throughout the show, images reappear to influence each other. The image of a model with the Iranian neo-Nazi party Simco, which was hired by Western forces to protect their oil interests in Iran to overthrow the democratically elected leader. All these issues of power, you know, Fidel Castro being a body painting. Title of this painting is "The Dead Do Not Revolt." And here is Simca. And this is a portrait within the same show with 22 karat gold called "Were You of Silver, Were You of Gold?" So these types of conflicts and the type of relationships of power, authority, politics, the militaristic state were all being looked at within that body of work. And again, that sense of creating reality of narratives of, that are truthful or untruthful. This is an exhibition titled Painting and Misappropriation at the Swiss Institute in New York, where images from the Swiss artist that I mentioned, Olaf Dietrich, were combined with my own work to create a narrative of the relationship of my work and his work that actually doesn't exist. But that as a fiction, as a new narrative, it created the sense that that appropriation, where I remade one of his beautiful painting of cactuses, of night cactuses, into a 12-foot square painting, where Der Bodensee and Message Force Multiplier are actually being shown with the paintings that I appropriated from. It started to develop a new type of look that challenged the stability of history, the challenge, what is real, what could be believed. Here is my owl painting with Adolf, Adolf's owl painting. Now, his story was one that was very interesting because he used the media to create the impression that he was an outsider artist, when in fact he was this guy living in a small town in Switzerland was making, he lived a solitary life, but he was, very sociable. Everybody came over to his house. I actually went to Switzerland, visited his house, and sat down at the table where he made all of these paintings, which was quite remarkable after I made the show. And so it was a very kind of eerie sense of communication between painters that way. But he used, his dealer and him took photographs of him out, sawing wood in the forest and doing all this crazy stuff to give the sense that he was someone who he was not. And in that sense, we had a kind of interesting parallel between the works. These are other images of pictures with symbols of psychedelia, symbols of neo-folk ideas that set up the show, which was the show titled Most Wanted that Terry referred to. Now, this was kind of my, maxing out of the idea of pop art. All the images that were done in this exhibition were gleaned from popular tabloid media. They were all images, we have Robert Pattinson with Louis Vuitton, and we have, Zac Efron with Versace, and we have Justin Timberlake with Calvin Klein, Leo, DiCaprio with Cartier. I had reached this point where it seemed to me that painting, the idea of abstraction in painting could come down to, again, the blank canvas. Except what would you need for that blank canvas? You would need a luxury brand sponsor and a celebrity endorsement. So each of these paintings has a luxury brand sponsor and a celebrity endorsement. And it wasn't just the guys. It was the girls. And so you have Miley Cyrus, Taylor Momsen from Gossip Girl, who's we've seen and come and go in the short period of time that this show has been up. You have Kristen Stewart, Taylor Swift, and Dakota Fanning. On the back wall, there is a step and repeat that we often see at our gala events where people lend their portrait to a backdrop with all the sponsors' brands. So within this show, you could make your own most wanted image, and everything would work out. You have Kristen with Yves Saint Laurent, and you have Taylor Momsen with Chanel. And so it kind of, that whole sense of appropriation of the mediated face, of the sense of the constructed face for media, all these, are rehearsed expressions where if we call out Taylor's name, she's going to give you that look again and again and again without fail. Same with all those things. Paintings could be that space, could occupy that space. And in that show, and at the opening, the people came out and, made their own versions of it. And also, there was we worked with a magazine, Dazed and Confused, and they brought their own, celebrity elements and, the people that came into it. So there was this kind of very strange quality of all of this kind of converging in one space. And which had its other dynamic, which is the inverse of that. This is a portrait of Lindsay Lohan made at within the midst of that exhibition. I made a portrait for the 2x2 benefit in Dallas. And that portrait was of Lindsay Lohan in the courtroom scene after she had just heard the verdict of what her fate would be. And to me, it struck me as this, I had been working on all these other kind of constructed images, and it struck me in a certain sense of reality that I couldn't believe. Well, with her, this painting took on a kind of Edvard Munchian type of strange feeling, and a friend of mine really loved this painting and had it on his phone. And he happened to be on a photo shoot with Lindsay in Los Angeles, and then showed it to Lindsay, and she said, "Oh my God, that's amazing! Who made this picture?" And he said, "Oh well, this is a friend of mine. He's an artist. He made this big painting, and it was at this benefit in Dallas, and it went really well and everything." And she said, "Oh my God, well, I want to be in touch with him." And he said, "Oh yeah, you guys should work together." So I started this little communication with Lindsay shortly thereafter. And at the time, she was in a great deal of legal trouble. In fact, she was out on bail. And, we were considering working together to make some portrait paintings. At that very moment, a friend of mine called me about a project that he was doing in Venice, where, we're doing a group of commercial-length films that would focus on art's relationship to commercial media or lack thereof, and would you be interested in doing it? And I said, "Well, I've never made a film before, never even made an iPhone film before, but sure, I'll do it." And then at that point I realized, well, I have an actress, I guess I'll call, so I texted Lindsay and said, "Well, would you be interested in making a film?" And so I'm going to kind of skip over this. So I did. And this is my film, which is titled Lindsay Lohan, and it's 90 seconds, and it appeared, it actually didn't appear because the project actually never happened in Venice. It happened in the media, but never in the actual site. But as far as the media was concerned, globally, it happened, go to Venice and see Lindsay Lohan and this film as, her artwork. And so that was a really interesting sense of how media could kind of that space of media, especially for a project as big as the Venice Biennale, that space laid completely unclaimed. And so when we had finished the film, and I realized that it was not going to happen, the idea of this barge going down the middle of the Venice Canal with a LED video screen wasn't going to happen, we decided to release this film 3 days ahead of the Venice Biennale and take over that mediated space, which we did do. And this film now that you're about to see has now been seen nearly 4 million times on YouTube, and anyone can go see it at home, but it's better to see it big, so we can go ahead. So that was my first film, and it was made with a collaboration of a great filmmaker, Taylor Steele, who is probably one of the best known contemporary surf filmmakers. And the way that, like, there's a lot of serendipity in this whole project, and all of the projects that I have to talk about that takes me out of the studio and goes out into the thin air of I don't know what. But I happen to be a judge. I'm a surfer, and I happen to be a judge in the New York Surf Film Festival for a couple of years. And I had the chance of meeting Taylor, who has made, you know, possibly the greatest surf films of multiple generations. And so at that moment when I was asked to do a film, I was panicking because I didn't know how to make a film. And so I called up Taylor and I said, hey, we have this opportunity. Do you want to join me and do that? So he got together his group of guys that typically travel all over the world to some of the most dangerous and, you know, frightful waves that we've ever come to know, and we know them because of him. And these guys happen to be able to converge on L.A. all at the same time. So we shot the film, Lindsay Lohan, in a single day in Malibu, and then the next day we had another film that we were going to make, and this one was with a very different actress who we'll get to. So we released the film, we created these film stills, and they became the placeholders for the image online and in various forms of media. This will become important later. So these images, again, like on the Huffington Post and on the New York Times, the films were released on the New York Times website ahead of the Biennale, and that was an important thing because then it actually made it go viral to the degree that I was in Switzerland with Adolf Dietrich's show in a monastery, and I went into Zurich that night, and only hours after the film had been released, I was at a dinner where I knew very few people at all, and they had already seen the film, and they said, you're the guy that made that, and so I could see that there was a different form of communication that was happening, the rapidity in which things could spread out into the world, given the infrastructure of Lindsay's popularity, which was a decision that we were all talked about, it was quite startling to see how fast that happened. So the next day, we got together, and all along that I've been talking to Lindsay, I've been talking to the actress Sasha Gray. Now, she's really known for her work in the adult industry. She's transformed the adult world with her films from the age of 18, and in 5 short years took it over and became one of the most popular adult actresses. When we worked together, it was only 5 days before her retirement, and after the fact that she had done a film with Steven Soderbergh called The Girlfriend Experience and had appeared on an entire season of Entourage as Vince's girlfriend. Both of these films had the exact same storyboard, that also should be said. And those storyboards were based on 2 films. One was Ingmar Bergman's Persona, and the other was on Godard's Contempt. So you'll see those types of imagery overlaying them. And at the time when I was speaking to both actors, I said, I'm not really a video artist per se, and I certainly, this is not going to be cinema. But what I do know is that, art has elasticity, that there's a potential to create art, and that we would consider these kind of motion portraits. I mean, I don't think I used that term until later after we were watching them, but at any rate, this is the second film. It's titled Sasha Gray. Thank you.
Great.
So again, these images went out into the press, into the media, and they became placeholders. They also became the selection of the images were made by millions of people and not just me. Those placeholders became paintings. And the paintings and combinations of the film were exhibited at Gagosian Gallery last fall. And so that experience of seeing images in film become paintings and the paintings sort of become the film as you go into the space was an experience that I hadn't had before I made the show. And it was a relationship between that irreality that I talked about before, that sense of what painting could do beyond reason, that really manifests itself in a way that I'd not ever experienced. All of the things that I'd kind of been arguing about with my work in various ways had been kind of put aside, and that this new reality, a visual reality that included this motion portraiture that was a collaboration with the subject and them, showing me as much as I could show them in terms of what of the work would be about, turned into paintings. Now, at the same time as I did the film, I did a photo shoot with Adriana Lima for Visionaire, which is a an entity in New York that does special projects with artists and also has a magazine called V Magazine. Working with Adriana Lima it was like working with Lindsay as an actor, a former adult actress, and Sasha Gray, and the top Victoria's Secret model, Adriana Lima, on the icons of Brazil, like portrayed against here as the sidewalk of Copacabana. And, this is the placeholder painting for Sasha. The sense of physicality, too, is also, these are like cinema scale now. The paintings are not just big for, like, the painting upstairs for its own sense of corporal scale, but it's a cinema scale, which has a different type of effect on our minds, especially when the films are close at hand and you're in context with them. So the sense of light projecting on a wall and occupying reality, and a painting being a physically made object from nothing, from the start of nothing, has a kind of duality that became interesting within the film. Still like looking at that. I know we've run over a little bit, and thanks everybody. I'm gonna, this is from. Conversely, also my final film with Lindsay for Art Unlimited in Basel, titled First Point. And after we had done that first film together, we had thought we should do something more. We should work together again. So a year later, we got together, and under the idea that we're going to do kind of a photo shoot for a magazine, ended up making our second film titled First Point, which. Kind of conceived of, in LA, in an almost offhand way, using a film that I found in a surf shop, and rewatching of Lost Highway. So we had kind of a surf noir subject going together that worked in the for our film titled First Point, which made its debut at Art Unlimited in Basel. And this is. All these images will make sense very quickly once we get on to the next film. Again, Adriana Lima on top of inverted in cruciform on top of the Catholic Church in Brasilia. And there she is in front of the favelas in Rio. It's a very large painting, like 12 and a half foot long, large painting. And this portrait was a portrait that was intended to be in the show, but it was kind of in the show, except a few miles away here, down here in Dallas, Texas, at the 2x2. And what it really was coming really full circle in a lot of different ways to my relationship with this community down here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. I mean, and not only is it's the opportunity that I got with John Runyon and Kenneth Turner early on, but it's also a long relationship that I've had over the years that I'm very honored and to have this privilege tonight to to show you my work, to discuss a bit about how it has come together, the way it came together for this portrait of Lindsay as, you know, in her persona turtleneck here that ended up being seen at the Howard and Cindy Wachowski's beautiful home, and with all of the works that were donated by artists for 2x2 and AIDS research and the Dallas Museum. So it is a really a very special moment for me to be able to come full circle and to show how this really a collaboration between communities and artists have this kind of enduring possibility, and one that I'm very happy to have been able to be a part of, and still very stunned and energized by visiting the museum. And we're going to go out and thank everybody for taking time, and we're going to just go out with it's a short film, only 6 minutes or less. I think it's 5 minutes and some odd. I said it was six, but we have starring Lindsay Lohan and the surfer Kasia Mador doing the who's a great pro surfer who I'm ever grateful for working with us on the film. So here is First Point. Thank you. soundtrack, I wanted to say also, was done by Thomas Bangalter, who is one half of Daft Punk, and it was original score for the film. And I worked with Jay Rabinowitz, who was my helping with editing on this film too, and who also did Tree of Life and other really great films. It was a real pleasure to be able to work with such great artists as well. So that sense of collaboration was really there in all of those works. But again, I want to thank everybody for coming tonight and taking time on this journey with me. I know I ran over a little bit, hopefully not too much. I'm also, I love questions. I know we've been here for a little bit, but if anybody wants to throw out a question, that's one of my things is I love to answer questions. So if there's any questions, or I'd be happy, you know, to address that. So,
when it comes to your technique, you're obviously an amazing painter, and so a lot of the explanations of your work are really interesting. But it seems to me like it's still very much about your being a painter.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if is your technique evolving a lot?
Well, thank you, first of all, for saying that. It has evolved a lot. Technically, the paintings have changed a lot from the very first part, where it was like a conventional use of charcoal drawing, and then scaling the charcoal drawing up with a grid onto a larger surface, working on a grisaille and underpainting, and then following through with a rather direct painted process using oil paint and oil medium. For that whole process. And it was in a very traditional, it's like in any book on oil painting technique covering like a Venetian style painting. All the types of the imprimatura, the preparation of the ground, all of those things, especially even in the painting that's upstairs, really goes into that kind of physical experience of the picture, where that other sense of beyond reason is taking painting to a level where it's past reasoning why you would actually go so far to do it that way, why you would not use like an industrial method or have like an army of 100 assistants working on churning out paintings. Each of the paintings that you saw up there was made by only me, no assistants, no extra stuff. It was about that one-to-one relationship with an image and with the sensitivity that goes into that. And I'm really glad you brought that up, because there is an idea that, oh yeah, there must be like, it's a New York situation or a big studio in Leipzig where you've got like 15, or it's in China, like I've hired people in Vietnam to paint these things. I the time crunch that I had for this last exhibition, I will admit I had hired somebody to come in to try to help me paint. They were with me for 2 days, and then I let them go and repainted everything that they painted, because there's just no way of communicating all that goes into making any one of these paintings. Like even the most recent ones, the more cinematic ones, the method really changed, but the sense that all of what you see is that direct experience that comes from painting. I mean, literally like this, and that's important to me, because it's the medium still amazes me. It still opens doors. As much as you think you know about how it's happening in one way, like as soon as you get to that point, it's like a video game. A whole nother world opens up. The difference between the newest work is that since I was taking the photographs and no longer appropriating them, that was a huge shift. And since I was talking to the people that I would be working with, just like I'm talking to you, that sense of what the image would mean took on a different relationship. So I began, previous to that, with the Most Wanted paintings by trying to use big silk screens of the source images and then paint it on top of them, using them as a kind of grisaille or underpainting, which would typically take weeks to work out in monochrome. With the new ones, I worked with a printer in Germany where we took film stills, captures, and then using an archival inkjet process onto heavy linen, you know, printed out the film stills that had been used as the placeholders in the media. And we used just we up-res them using this algorithm to make that the grisaille or the charcoal drawings that I had started out with. So in a sense, the paintings became less about mimicking like a methodological procedure and more about performance. They were kind of like the films themselves, where I painted, even that painting of Lindsay on her back, I painted in 11 days. I mean, it was an endurance thing, but it was, you know, and the painting is entirely covered with paint, but the sense that you eradicate the photographic, you're eradicating the film now, that painting emerges as the thing that you connect with. There's an uncanny relationship that I still can't figure out why. But I know it's there when I'm standing in front of it. I know it's there when I, you know, came upon it today when I saw it upstairs. That really excites me. And, you know, and it's the way that images collapse and become not themselves again.
Have you ever considered chronicling that process that you just described with someone photographing you actually making the paintings?
I've been asked to, and I have done stages, but I haven't like set up the GoPro cameras all over the studio, which in the end is something I should probably time-lapse it just to see. But it's, you know, I don't know if it's superstition or whether I'm shy. I don't, you know, you know, even in my cameos on Gossip Girl, it was kind of silly. But, you know, I like being in front of the camera to some degree, but I don't know. In painting, it's sort of like, I'm not there, you know. Yeah, actually, I actually can get to the truth of the matter, which is that painting is about 90% or maybe 98% procrastination, and it's just terrible. I mean, I honestly can't tell you. It's like you are in the studio and you're faced with painting a difficult passage in the painting, and it's the last. And it's like, I don't want to do it. You know, I'm going to screw this up, and I've gotten it to this point, and if I screw this up, there will be no way back, and I'll have to start all over again. And so then the pressure is on, and then I'll be like reading the newspaper, going online, drinking a cup of coffee, like, you know, making a phone call, doing whatever I can do to not have to face this reality. And it's a solitary one, you know, go turn on the music. And then eventually the pressure is to the point where it's like, oh my God, I've got this deadline, you know, 2x2 is coming up or something, and, you know, and you have to decide and perform that experience, you know. And so I think that those films that, you know, would be very weird, you know, of me just like sitting around doing nothing and like kind of going like, ah, oh man, I got to do this. And then you do it, and then it's like there's no safety net, there's no nothing, and it's just like painting into that void of expression. But that's, I mean, in the end, I love what it holds out. I mean, that the sense that there is this potential for drastic failure and letdown is why it's so exciting when something turns out and something uncanny appears. And it seems more real than reality itself. I mean, that's where I agree with the, you know, it being, my paintings sometimes being referred to as super real, but it's not in that traditional sense of what super real meant.
So where do you go from here with your art?
Sculpture. You know, I'm working on a sculpture right now. I've been working on one since November, and it's a sculpture in aluminum, steel, and carbon fiber. And I'm thinking that there will be a film component involved in that, and then maybe paintings. But it to me, that the sense of serendipity and saying yes, and that's another thing that I always want to remind myself to say, and when I speak publicly, is that you never know what happens when you say yes. You know, and when I said yes to Neville Wakefield and, you know, Dasha for Commercial Break, or for Art Unlimited, when I said yes to Gianni Yetzer, or, you know, and likewise when Gianni and I did the show with Adolf Dittrich, you go on these journeys, and you don't, and it's, in intentionality falls by the wayside with all these discoveries that can be made. And I think that all of the painting that I did got me up to the point where things suddenly opened up again. And that's where I wanted to do more of a strict presentation tonight of seeing only works within the conventional confines of galleries and museums, because in a way those are the core elements that move me forward, and I'm very excited about what this new potential holds. I actually, like the films, don't know whether it's art, but I'm hoping that it may stretch the boundaries of it, because in the end, art is often what we don't know that it is.
Great. Thank you so much.